The challenge people have is that we all know on some level, like I mean, science fiction comes from somewhere, right? Fantasy comes from somewhere. Like if you take kind of an elevated perspective and you look for the patterns and the symbols, like we are absolutely on this quest to figure things out. Are we here alone? Are we not here alone? Is this possible? Is this not possible? And I remember distinctly being in grad school reading Plato and being like, the Matrix ripped off Plato.
That was Tonya Rekla. And this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is where I get to use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to explore all types of topics with some great guests. And I want to get into things right away this week because today's conversation is about the importance of being open to possibilities. It's also about play, and it's also about fear and power. And I have to admit that it's a conversation that challenged me a little bit, as I think you'll hear when you listen to it. My guest is Tonya Rekla. Tonya is a former U.S. counterintelligence agent. She owns a company with her husband that specializes in online reputation and risk management. And she's also the executive director of something called Superpower Experts, which helps people achieve enlightened self-actualization. And this involves things like energy manipulation, transmutation, and other things. And you might want to call them intuitive powers. Now, I have to admit that there are some things in all of that that I find challenging, as you'll hear. And I have some cognitive dissonance around, on the one hand, being open to possibilities that uncertainty provides, and on the other, being wary of things that aren't in some way backed by science and reason. However, one of the things that was absolutely clear is that Tonya is great at making people open to possibilities that they didn't know existed and in making people aware of power that they didn't know they had. She's a big picture person, which also comes through when we talk about polygraph tests. So I actually took a lot out of this conversation in which we cover all the things I talked about and a lot more. I think you'll get a lot out of it too. So without any further delay, here's Tonya Rekla. So, Tonya, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting. Your background really intrigued me, and I thought we'd have a really good conversation. I always start off, so I don't have a set of questions that are sort of pre-programmed, but I often start with this question, and that is, when you're asked what it is that you do, how do you answer that question?
Oh my goodness. It depends on the moment, honestly, yeah. Because we being my husband and our daughter, have our hands in so many different things that sometimes context is really important for that question. Ultimately, at the end of the day, all of our businesses, everything that we do is leading towards empowerment and transformation for folks. We do that through risk mitigation in one business. We do it through superpowers and personal development in another. We do it through promoting our 7-year-old daughter and her work with kid entrepreneurs and stuff. So, but the underlying thread, if you will, the energy currency is connecting with people and assisting them in transforming.
Very cool. And if you've my listeners will now know that this I'm after the people that kind of struggle to answer that question. Because, you know, these are the most interesting people in the world, and that's who I want to talk to. So that's great. So if we're going to talk a little bit about superpowers and what you mean by them, and like any good superhero, you have an origin story. I want to get into your background and, you know, how I know that you spent some time in counterintelligence, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explore that a little bit. And you studied you studied cultural dynamics as well. So I want to get into that and what led you to studying the things that you studied and then getting into that work. So maybe if you just give a little bit of background, you're an American, you grew up in the US for most of your, most or all of your childhood or?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was born in Kansas. I was raised in Tucson, Arizona, and then, you know, traveled a bunch and everything else, but in the States primarily. In fact, when I was an agent, I worked almost exclusively in the States.
Right. Right. Okay, well let's get into that because it's did you always want to be? I mean, what first of all, when you say I was an agent, what was that? What is that? What exactly does that mean?
So I was a federal agent. I was a special agent for the United States government and in the realm of counterintelligence.
Right.
And so I can kind of. That kind of confounds people a little bit. And most of the time they say, you know, think James Bond, you know, so there were some kind of sexy sides to it. But as you can imagine, it was also a job and there were some not so sexy sides to it. But ultimately, the field of counterintelligence is really focused on, you know, making sure that we know how our enemies, if you will, are gathering information against the country and then, you know, thwarting those efforts. And I did that I did surveillance as well as investigations of folks that we suspected of passing information on. Mm-hmm. So
were you working for which agency were you working for?
The agency I worked for actually doesn't exist anymore. It was housed out of the military. And so I did a stint as an Army soldier and then was recruited by this agency and, the outfit that I worked for doesn't really exist anymore. So, but it was more focused on military aspects versus like the CIA or the FBI.
Right, right. So it's less about tracking terrorist groups who might blow something up in a civilian sense, and more about or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe you'll have to kill me after you tell me. But
everybody listening, no, just kidding. But no, there was some terrorism aspects to it. The organization I worked for was more focused on espionage and less on terrorism, but it wasn't unusual for those two to be kind of interlinked.
Okay. And how did you get into that?
It makes no logical sense. Anybody who knew me, you know, when I was in college, my bachelor's degree is in intercultural communication and my master's degree is in a field of critical race theory. So I was always fascinated with how people interact, like what moves them, human behavior, human potential. And of course, now in retrospect, it all makes sense, but it didn't make really any sense at the time. And I was very, very, very liberal, you know, to the point where I was involved in some kind of sit-ins and stuff like that about the Republican debates and was never like was super opposed to anything military or conservative or anything. And what happened here, you know, I finished my master's degree in May of 2001. And then, as we all know, in September of that year, everything kind of changed here. Like there was just something shifted. And again, at that time, I didn't know the energetic impact of what 9/11 did here. But it wasn't long after that that I kind of almost on autopilot or in this surreal alternate universe kind of found myself at an Army recruiter. And I was, you know, 27 and I had a master's degree. And it just really was unusual that anyone in that life circumstance would enlist in the Army. But it just, you know, and all I wanted to do was counter intel. And to be honest with you, I don't know that I even totally knew why. And again, now in retrospect, I kind of get that I was, you know, kind of guiding myself in a direction or God was guiding me or what, you know, whatever force that is that kind of compels us. And the irony was that the recruiters, you know, wanted me to be an officer because of my education. And in the Army at that time, I don't know if it's the case anymore here in the States, in order to be guaranteed a specific job, you have to enlist. And I said, all I want is this job. And so I don't care if I have to go in an enlisted capacity. So that means, you know, lower ranking. That's what I was going to do. And they were kind of beside themselves and weren't real sure they were going to let me do it. And I was like, it's that or nothing, you know? And so I enlisted at 27 and I remember being at basic training with, you know, some 17-year-olds and stuff like that, and just kind of observing all of it, almost like an out-of-body experience. Like, how am I here? Like, how did this happen? Like, who am I? And but followed the field of counterintel, first in the Army, very short stint in the Army. I got injured and was medically discharged, and then recruited by an agency, which was lucky in retrospect because I got to do a lot of things in conjunction with that agency that I would never have been able to do, or would have taken a very long time in a military career to be able to do it. So I did surveillance and investigations, and I also testified in federal court on a case. And so it just a lot of really random things that in retrospect I really shouldn't have been able to do. But it just kind of unfolded from that place. So I can't really tell you how it happened. I just know the details surrounding the fact that it did happen.
Right. Did you enter into that or seek counterintelligence because of you thought it would be a cool job, or you thought you could apply your skills, or what was it? Did you have any influences that led you into that you can now point to?
You know, I remember a conversation. I was dating a guy who was in the Army, and he was in another field of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying, you know, just like with how my mind works and, you know, how I observe the world, that I would be a phenomenal counterintel agent. Okay. And, I didn't really know, you know. I was like, well, what does that mean? And he talked about it, and I was like, yeah, okay, that feels right. Okay, cool. And it was, I think it was more just almost a resonance thing versus a logic thing. And it just kind of worked. Just like when I got stationed at the, my first position as an agent, it was a big deal to kind of have that position, but I didn't know, you know. I was just naive enough that I was like, okay, sure. Yeah, I'll do that. And everyone's like, wait, you're going to work where? And I'm like, I get from your tone that that's a big deal, but I really have no comprehension of that. It was like, I felt very much like a fish out of water.
When you say it was a resonance thing, what do you mean by that?
Resonance.
So like, oh, gotcha.
Like, yeah, a frequency. I thought, okay, and energy.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I misheard that. Okay. That's really, I think there's a lot there.
I'm sure.
What, when we say counterintelligence, I kind of see where you, maybe your skill set, either your training, your skill set, the way your mind works, the way you think, might be very valuable, because if you study things like group dynamics and how people think and how groups of people think, then you can probably use that very, you know, very effectively in counterintelligence work. Is that what ended up happening? Is that what you ended up doing, or what was, did your skills not come into play when you started that job?
There were a lot of areas that I was extremely deficient in, especially in the military, and in the government as well. Mm-hmm. But the areas that you're talking about were absolutely beneficial, and I ended up using a skill set that I didn't even totally understand. And so obviously now working in the superpower realm and kind of diving into, I did a bit of journeying into like the whole woo-woo arenas and some of the metaphysical stuff. And I understand it better now what was occurring then, but I wasn't in awareness of it. I wasn't consciously aware at the time. But I happened to, like, I always thought I was just very, very smart. Like, people, that's just what people told me. And so I was in gifted education and, you know, honors college and all this other stuff. And so I just really thought that I had, you know, that it was my mind. And while my mind is an amazing and valuable tool, it was, I was much more intuitively guided than I was aware of. Mm-hmm. And so I just knew things. And so in the counterintelligence field, the work that I was doing specifically, I found that where I was deficient was in details and timelines, and that, like, my mind just doesn't retain that kind of information well or easily. And I didn't have an illustrious military career to draw on. So when information, so if I was in an investigation, if I was in an interview, and I was paired up with a partner who was very detail minded, we worked very well together because the information I was picking up on existed somewhere else. You know, there were nuances, and so where people, you know, are always like, you know, teach me how to do lie detection. And I'm like, you know, that's not really my shtick. In fact, I would argue anybody that said that lie detection is a science, but it, but what I do pick up on is incongruities in people. And so the way we speak with both our words, as well as our bodies, as well as our energy. And what really intrigued me was that some of the worst spies in American history passed the polygraph numerous times. And so it's like, okay, the polygraph is designed, the practitioner gauges the words being spoken and the body language, the machine gauges the body language. What is being missed in that scenario? And I will contend that it's very, very, very few people have learned how to lie energetically. And so it's a really phenomenal way to gauge incongruities. Again, not necessarily to pick up on blatant lying, but if you are in tune energetically, you can sense that some aspect of what the person is saying or doing isn't in resonance within them. And sometimes they're not even consciously aware of it, but it's that those were the kind of things that I just got intrinsically. I just knew. And so when we go back and kind of recollect, or if we had a little break, it'd be like, there's something not right about this. And they're like, well, they said this, this, and this, and it makes sense. I said, it may make sense, but it's something's not kosher with that. Like something's not working there. And so we could go in and explore that further. So that was an ability that I had, but I didn't really understand it. And I felt, like I said before, I felt like a fish out of water, because the areas that were really applauded in that environment were more the detail-oriented, quick decision-making and that type of stuff, and surveillance in particular. Like, I was terrible at surveillance. Like, it was like, I don't know which way to go. Like, we could do that. You know, I was always gathering all this information, and I didn't even understand that I had the capacity to gather it.
Right. So how did your colleagues somehow take it when, you know, you're interrogating someone or whatever, and you say, something's not quite right, or I'm not liking the vibe or whatever. And then you've got these detailed oriented people that are saying, well, the chart is, not breaking this range of these numbers or whatever. How did that work? You said you're one of your partners, and you work very well with them, but how did you adjust, or how did they adjust?
Oh, and that's an interesting question. So there's an aspect of me that wants to say that they probably thought I was crazy. But there's another piece of me that gets that it was pretty seamless. So I think at the time, because I didn't have a lot of languaging around it, I was still kind of playing with it, that it was presented in a way that was more exploratory versus, you know, listen to me. I certainly didn't wield the authority around it that I could now, which was probably for the best, because I'm not sure that that would have gone over well in that environment. Right. But I don't know. That's a really good question. I think that in the work that I've done in the personal development arena, I realized that our memories really aren't flawless. And so there's always the overlay of the insecurities or whatever else we're working through. And so I don't think that I can answer that with any degree of honesty, because there's many parts of me that have different answers to that. So,
yeah, I think it's been proven that memories are, they're so bad. The way we remember certain things, and even when we get together with our friends, and do you remember that time when we did this? No, it was, we were over here, not over there. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Is this something that you developed? Because I want to get into this concept of superpowers and what you mean by superpowers. But do you think that in your somehow in your upbringing or your childhood experiences or whatever, you managed to cultivate certain skills that that others don't?
I think that there were different phases. I remember distinctly being in college, and we were a group of young female freshmen, and there was a group of older sophomore guys, and that we were kind of palling around with. And I remember very distinctly one of them pulling me aside and saying, people don't want to know that you can see them. And if you want to continue to be in our presence, you have to stop doing that. And I didn't really know what he was talking. Like, I really assumed that everybody could do it. Like, it wasn't something that I mean, when you do it and you do it naturally, it's like, it's not a big deal. But that was a really pivotal moment. And I remember staying up that whole night kind of asking myself. I knew it was kind of a gut level check moment. And in that moment, I chose acceptance and I chose friendship over being true to myself. And I shut it down. I don't know that I could ever have shut it down completely. I think I just chose to not give it voice. And over time, I allowed it to kind of take a back seat. But it was something that I'd always had. I didn't know it was unusual. And where I'm at now, I don't think it's that unusual. I just think that for whatever reason, I was acknowledging it. You know, I was able to see it and use it. I know we all have those abilities. And so that was a pivotal moment. And I would say it wasn't until I made the choice to leave government that I had to reawaken that piece of me. There was something distinctly missing, and it needed to come back. And so it was an intentional, conscious decision on my part to explore whatever that was and to do the work to reconnect with it.
When that guy said, you can, you know, I can't quite remember your quote, you can see through people or you can see them. Is that what he said? Something
see into them, yeah, or see them. Yeah,
sure, sure. What is that? I mean, what does that look like? What's an example of that? Is that sort of, would that be being able to kind of discern when someone's not being truthful, or what does that mean? Do you recall an example of that?
It's more pertinent now. So I see things very multidimensionally. And so I work a lot with frequencies and vibrations. And depending on which dimensional aspect of themselves people are attuned to, they exhibit certain signs and they say certain things. And they have certain certain understandings of truth. And so when people are talking to me, you know, we joke about it even in our home, you know, it's a big part of our daily conversation is, you know, which version of yourself are you listening to in that moment? So case in point, when you asked me the question earlier, is I was very aware that there was a small piece of me, you know, one of my pieces and parts, our daughter calls them like your gremlins, you know, that really kind of wanted to feel sorry for myself and say, oh, they didn't understand me and woe is me. That it still exists. It's still there. I get to choose which aspect of myself I give voice and which version of reality I want to live in. And so where I witness people is what I call the abstract frequency, where we are in our highest and where people are connected. And there's, you know, I tell people there's no separation between us. There's this oneness concept. There's a place where we exist. And that's truth. And we all sense it. We all kind of know it. And I just simply choose to not affirm people's lower frequency aspects of themselves. And so that plays into the work that I do, being able to mirror for people their highest aspect and assist them in associating with that aspect of themselves more so than any other, and doing the work to quiet those other voices.
Okay, that's quite, that's certainly very fascinating, and I'm kind of this is, you know, it's not something you hear people say very often, right? I guess when we talk about, so things like, so you talk about this concept of superpowers, and we have this ability to develop our intuition, and do and see things in a way that that perhaps is, we've always had, but is dormant, is uncultivated. I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit more about that. So, you know, if somebody comes to you and says, "Wow, you know, I just cannot understand. I've never had that experience. I cannot understand what you're, you know, how you're doing, you know, what you're doing, or I don't believe that I can, you know, develop these sorts of skills," or they're very skeptical about, you know, what is it? Gosh, what is it that you're talking about when you talk about superpowers? What do you mean by that? What are some of the things that you explain to people when they maybe you're first interacting with them?
Well, I think it's important to mention, like, I didn't come by superpowers naturally. Like, that was never in my shtick. In fact, we laugh. I never watched even, like, a Neverending Story or superpower stuff or comic books. I didn't do any of that stuff until I met my husband, and that was in my 30s. And I didn't play a lot as in my adulthood. Mm-hmm. And, so when I, started kind of hearing guidance, which I'm very intuitively guided, around this superpower concept, I was like, no thanks. Because I was a pretty serious person. I had serious careers. I was very educated. I was like, I'm kind of a toe-the-line kind of gal. And it just kind of kept coming back up. And so, I started to explore it. And we explored it more as a marketing strategy as opposed to an overall brand strategy for our personal development network. And people loved it. Like, the idea of superpowers is such, it's so ingrained in us as this kind of magical, powerful state of existence. And secretly, every single person I've talked to over the last, almost 2 years now we've been doing that podcast, it just livens everyone up. The idea that they might have superpowers. And I've talked to some extremely successful people in the world, and they're like, I've never thought about whether I have superpowers. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, absolutely you do. And so when it comes to the practice of it, I break superpowers up into what I call predisposed superpowers versus unique superpowers. Mm-hmm. And so predisposed superpowers would be things like psychic ability, empathy, intuition, mind reading, chameleon ability. Some of those things that they're just skills. Like, we all have access to them. We're predisposed to certain ones over the others, but we all can hone all of them. Just with a little bit of intention and diligence in that regard. The unique superpowers it really speaks to how we put all of it together. And so this whole time we've been talking about, like, what was my trajectory? Like, how did all of this come about? And what were the skill sets I was picking up along the way and the experiences I was having and the things I was working through, because there was a lot to be worked through as well. Why? What was that about? Because it was very unique to me, how I would tie it all together. That's the unique superpower. So kind of like, what are you here to do type of conversation, the mission purpose, if you will. And that takes different definitions based on which frequency people are sitting in. And so when you break that dialogue up into those two parts, the one that most people are super fascinated with is the flashy, like, obvious, demonstrable things like telepathy and telekinesis and time travel and everything else. And so that's the one that people really like to discuss, which is great. But we contend at Superpower Experts that your superpowers really only come online with any degree of reliability when you've first mastered your own personal power and you've agreed to use them for good. You kind of commit to doing good things in the world and you agree to work in conjunction with other people. Mm-hmm. Those three elements have to be present before people really truly start doing the miraculous. And those are the components that go into the training that we do.
Okay. So when you talk about things like telepathy and time travel and this sort of thing, I mean, that sounds like science fiction, right?
Of course.
And certainly to a lot of my, and to me, it's sort of, do these things really exist? And, and if so, how do we tap into that? And I guess what we also just heard you say is, I don't know about your views on time travel, but quite possibly we could be doing a lot more and achieving a lot more if we have a broader sense of purpose, and it takes work to understand what that is.
Absolutely. I think where people get caught up is that we see people kind of throwing around these powers who aren't using them for good or who haven't committed to, being of service to the collective. And so it's confusing because, if this, then this, right? Well, people can have blips of success with just about anything, but that doesn't mean that longitudinally it's going to be well-founded. And so what we're talking about is really the altering of your own existence so that there's consistency with that and you're clear on who you are and you're kind of guided by what you've agreed to do here. So I get the skepticism. The thing is that this stuff happens all the time. Mm-hmm. We just call it out. You know, we're just saying, look, we want to play with this. We want to say that this is happening. And a lot of what we see in the world has to do with what we're willing to say we choose to believe. You know, just by virtue of us saying, well, could superpowers be real? We start to create the construct that allows for that to even occur. So there was a very distinct point in my existence where I made a conscious choice to play. And I sat with it because I was like, I can't provide you proof. Like it really does come down to belief. And the world that I play in is counterintuitive to the world of proof and facts and science and everything else. There are science things that start to prove that, but I would contend that all science is based first in belief. And so then it gets really fuzzy. And for every factual discovery, there's equally factual discovery to counter it. So it's like, how do you choose it? And I just simply choose to create the world that I see. And I did it consciously. Like I really sat with them like, okay, what if I'm crazy? Like, what if I drank the Kool-Aid somewhere along the line and I'm just nuts and all of this is bullshit and I don't know, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, I went through down that rabbit hole. And at the end of the day, what I came up with was, let's say I die and I talk to whoever's after this or whatever occurs after this. And they're like, wow, that was really stupid. Like you totally went off path. It's like, okay, but am I having fun? Like, do I know that I'm touching people's lives? Like, is it, am I bringing joy into existences? Am I, you know, living an amazing life with my husband and my daughter? And like, there's tons of proof that that's occurring. So it's like, eh, that's not a bad gig, you know? And so it's like, what's the worst that it can be? And the worst that can be is that I live an amazing life. And at the end of it, I have to kind of do it all over because I missed the boat, you know, and I don't believe that to be true, but it helped quiet that piece of myself, because as you can imagine, given my education and my background, that I didn't come by that easily.
Right. Here's, you know, I have a bit of, admittedly, some cognitive dissonance with some of the things you're saying, but at the same time, I have a lot of you know, I can see where you're coming from, and I'll kind of spit out my you know, where I see if, what you're describing, and then you can, you know, you can let me know how that sort of fits. But so yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think it's very important to play. I also think that there's a whole range of stuff that we don't know about the world, right? And it's and it's arrogant of us to, you know, to think that we know everything about how things work, right? And there's all kinds of amazing things that, like, you know, that physicists are coming up with, you know, whether it's the Higgs boson or, you know, all of these things that, like, oh my God, this is just mind-boggling. Or about time, if you go and you look at Einstein's theories of time, you know, it's just like, it's really trippy how you know, they're different, you know, different planes, and, you know, the whole thing about if you were to go into a ship, you know, at the speed of light, and the baby that turns into the old man, and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And one of the amazing things about science as well is that whole thing about hypothesis formulation, right? We're going to test something. Mm-hmm. Where do you get the idea in the first place to test if something is true? And I think it's really important to keep our, you know, our minds absolutely open. I think it's a critical part of science to possibilities. And one of the things about my own podcast is about uncertainty, and that, you know, we don't know everything. So I'm, you know, I'm totally with you there. And I can also see, that there are a lot of people that are kind of, you know, in that space, right? You know, we need to know that there are these possibilities, and, you know, that there's more to the world than we actually know. And that's awesome. Where I get the sort of cognitive dissonance side of things happens is a couple of things. One is that when you get people who turn around and say, well, yes, this, you know, this does exist, and I, you know, if you follow me, I have the way, and you know,
and, I am your guru.
Know, I'm your guru, and you know, I'll teach you how to levitate or mind read, or you know, all of these kinds of things. That's where I find it a bit dangerous, because there are, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, the world of woo woo and you know, things that and frankly, you know, there's a lot of money in it, in whether it's supplements or you know, people that say outrageous things, or you know, or whatever. So I find, you know, I'm sometimes I find myself in with some cognitive dissonance around these two things.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if what I've just said is, you know, resonates or not, or if you've got some thoughts or views around it, but have you read the book called The Men Who Stare at Goats?
I have not, but no? I'm familiar with
okay.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was this so apparently it's a book about, I think it was made into a movie, in fact. Mm-hmm. But it was actually based on something apparently real, but it was a military experiment that, you know, they tried to train people into
yes.
Telepathy and all of this sort of stuff. And you know, hey, why not give it a shot, right?
Well, and it's funny to me, I'm glad you brought that up, because you know, I don't know about other countries, but our government has been doing that kind of stuff mm-hmm. forever. We worked with a guy who's part of the original remote viewing team. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so it's not unusual that the challenge people have, and I am laughing because I wanted to kind of interrupt you and be like, you're not going to drink my Kool-Aid, Ben? Like, come on. The challenge people have is that we all know on some level, like I mean, science fiction comes from somewhere, mm-hmm. right? Fantasy mm-hmm. comes from somewhere. Like if you take kind of an elevated perspective and you look for the patterns and the symbols, like we are absolutely on this quest to figure things out. Are we here alone? Are we not here mm-hmm. alone? Is this possible? Mm-hmm. Is this not possible? And I remember distinctly being in grad school reading Plato and being like, the Matrix ripped off Plato. Like, yeah, I'm like, yeah. what, you know, yeah, with the Matrix.
And where does that come from? Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so there's yeah. these, like, I can't deny the patterns. And that's how my mind works, yeah, is I see yeah. patterns and symbols and processes and stuff like that. And so it's the challenge isn't in the knowing. People are always willing yeah. to explore concepts.
Yeah.
Where most people get stuck is they're not willing to change their lives or their behavior based on it. And so you mentioned yeah. Einstein. It's not that we haven't known this stuff for yeah. a very long time. Yeah. What does it mean to live it yes. and to enact it in yeah. our existence? Because to enact it in our existence, I mean, we're still teaching Newtonian physics despite the fact that Einstein came up with this mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, people still believe that things are solid. And it's like, but we've known for decades, probably eons, that that's not the case. What has to shift before we're willing to say, mm-hmm. okay, what, why are we in direct opposition to that? What are we served by staying in a state of behavior that we know is counter to a lot of things, that if you really tap into yourself, you can feel the truth of it. You're like, there's no way, mm-hmm. like you said, it would be very egotistical of us to think that we, like our brains are capable of comprehending everything that exists.
Yeah, and very dangerous as well, Tony, because if we don't have, you know, question things, and you know, I think that part of what makes us human is getting up in the morning and having that sort of sense of purpose and wonder and, you know, trying to figure some of the stuff out, right?
Right.
It's dangerous if we just sort of take it all as a fait accompli. We're in some mm-hmm. ways we're denying, you know, we're denying a core aspect of our humanity if we're not doing that.
Absolutely. Well, not, and I'll be honest, like I really struggled with moving into this work. This was not yeah. on my plans. Like this yeah. was not, I didn't want to be a coach. I didn't want none of this stuff. In fact, I kind of kicked and screamed the whole way. And the biggest part was exactly what you talked about, is like, I'm not interested in telling people how to live their existence or claiming that I have some methodology that they can employ that's going to change their existence. And what changed it for me was that I am absolutely capable of, and I believe it's a worthy thing to do, to assist people in developing their own. First, it was mastering their own personal power. Then I started working with people's mm-hmm. energy signatures and how to kind of manage their own individual resonance, moving them into a state of autonomy. And that I am comfortable doing, because it doesn't, it allows people to be their own authority. And when you really start to deconstruct most people's existences, they abdicate authority on so many levels to ultimately comes down to fear. But whether it's to keep a job, whether it's to, you know, keep up with the Joneses, whether it's to pay your bills, like, it doesn't matter what it is. But when you start to remove the element of fear from your decision making, you get closer and closer and closer to full sovereignty for yourself. To me, that's a worthy journey. And it was about 2 years ago, I started asking, I wanted to be seen, I wanted to be shown anywhere in my existence that I was abdicating my own power, my intrinsic power, not force, not wielding it over someone else, but my own intrinsic power over myself and my decision making, where I was abdicating that to anything outside of myself. And I was shown, and it sucked. Like, it's quite the journey into those deep recesses of our existence, but the work is worthy from the sense that that is true and utter freedom. And ultimately, my belief is that we are all seeking freedom on some level.
Yeah, you talk about that a lot, right? Freedom. So when you talk about some of that work that you do, could you expand on that a little bit? What does that look like, and how do you? What are some of the steps you take someone through, and what does that entail, and then how does that, you know, link into sort of the concept, as you say, of freedom?
So that, again, it's a multidimensional answer, because we have what's called, at Superpower Experts, we have the Superpower Net, and that's our membership base. And it's purposely designed to meet people wherever they're at. And so we have experts, and we have other people, there's peer-to-peer learning, there's classes. So some people, really, this is the first time they've even thought of anything transformational. They're just feeling compelled to make a change in their existence.
Sure.
And so we meet those people where they're at. Like, we don't jump in and go, hey, now you can fly. You know, that's not, really our shtick. But it's just getting them in touch with themselves. I only work with people who truly are in a position to and are capable of working in what I call that abstract frequency. And it is, in my opinion, the highest level of self-responsibility we can take. And what that means is I hold people accountable to anywhere that they're abdicating any aspect of their existence. And so my BS meter is pretty attuned. And so when they go into kind of stories or old behaviors or old anything, I can sometimes gently, sometimes not so gently, kind of depends on the situation, help them see where they're buying into something that may not need to be true for them anymore. And so it's, it's similar to, I would imagine, most kind of coaching type work, with the exception that I do not honor, nor do I engage people's lower frequency aspects. And my job is to model for them what it looks like to not do that, and to give them practical, my role is the integration piece. Like, I'm not interested in theories and philosophies that can't be implemented. And so I assist in the implementation process. And most of our people are ones who are here to make a significant change. So either they're running like multi-billion-dollar companies that are providing sustainable solutions, or they're touching people's lives in a unique way. They're here to do work, and people are waiting for them to do that work. And so my job is to hold them accountable to doing it at the highest level possible.
Right. When you say lower frequencies, what does that mean?
It may just be like our colorful, fun language and superpowers, but it is really kind of how I see things. Let me think if there's another kind of parallel construct for it. Ego, you know, it's no different than the ego theory or Jungian theories around the shadow elements. Like, it's the base elements, the survival pieces, Maslow's hierarchy, if you will.
Right, got it. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. But I actually see it as frequencies. Like, I can feel the difference. And so my body is like attuning for it. Like, I can feel where people are coming from, and but that's the work that I've agreed to do here. And so I've honed those abilities.
Okay. Yeah, no, got it. What type of work is involved in getting to this sort of place of not making decisions on the basis of fear and having this sort of freedom and sovereignty? Because I think we all have different fears, and some, you know, many of us never address them. And a lot of people go to their graves, you know, having lived, a lot of their lives in fear. How do you counsel people kind of confronting those fears, or trying to go and do the things that make them afraid, or what? What?
No. It actually makes my job 1,000 times more difficult if people are triggered in the midst of work. And so that includes money fears. It includes a lot of people don't move into that space because they're afraid of losing a relationship with somebody.
Yeah.
It doesn't do me any good to be like, oh, yeah, you got to give it all up. That was my journey. I was always kind of the, you know, crash the tower down and then go and rebuild it. Like that was kind of how that's how I was able to move as fast as I was. But you don't have to do that. Like, I'm a big believer in, ease and grace and being loving with yourself and loving with others. And, you know, we haven't gotten into any of that at all, but really that is the underlying thing. I work a lot in that frequency of love, and it is connection. And so if we believe that we're all interconnected, you know, that you or me and I am you in some aspect, in some higher echelon of the universe or multiverse, then, you know, a lot of times it's just connecting those pieces and just being in harmony with each other and with ourselves. Right. And so the stories don't matter. You know, I spent the beginning of my journey, you know, kind of my book from about 10 years ago was about, you know, personal power and safety and self-awareness and situational awareness. And I talk about being raped by one of my team members. And so that was more of a kind of power and personal power as it relates to survivability. And as we move kind of up in the echelons, that conversation changes. And so what I found is that those pieces are just those pieces of fear. Really, the quickest, swiftest approach with them is just loving them and kind of moving them, asking them, you know, what the message was. Usually, if you can reframe for people why and how things occurred, then it's an easy process, and they're able to see it differently. And so, for example, I talked to someone the other day about her mother had passed, and she just had a lot of residual stuff around that, like, you know, how she had been raised and all this other stuff. And as I was talking with her, I was able to pick up on information. I said, you know, what if we reframe that? What if this was what occurred there? Like, what if your mother had agreed to show you this, and that? You know, just kind of a gentle reframing. And the beautiful thing about the work that I do is that people already know. It's their information. It's their truth. I'm simply delivering it to them as something outside of them, and it makes it much more believable than the dialogues that happen within us. Because as soon as I can say it, people can feel in their body the truth of it. You know, it feels expansive, or it feels like chills, or it feels like some visceral effect that occurs. I don't have to prove it. Like, I don't have to say, well, but no, it is true. It is. They know. It's just that we don't listen to that piece of ourselves enough. And so I'm just the voice of it that allows people to really hear it for sometimes for the first time and go, wow, I am amazing. You know, I really am. And all the things I've been telling myself, just like the example we had earlier, like I could sit and chastise myself for being a shitty agent and being a weirdo and all these other things. Or I could say, what was that? And maybe I did impact people. And I know for a fact that I touched people's lives by showing up in that way. I could have done it better for sure, but that's what I'm committed to now. And not kind of not prostituting myself in any way that says, you know, I think that I'm somehow smaller than I am. And I'm certainly not going to say that about anybody else, because I see them in their greatness. And that's just the vision of them that I hold.
It sounds wonderful. And I imagine you help a lot of people. I guess a couple of thoughts. I mean, I don't want to go into this too much. But you said you were raped by a team member. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to go into some, you know, into an area where, you know, you don't want to go, but I'm wondering how you overcame that, or how that influenced the work that you do.
Well, it was really beautiful, because I was raped when I was 16, and I was a virgin at that point in time, and I didn't do anything. I froze, right? And I didn't even understand. I was 16. I didn't totally understand anything. And I went through the next kind of 16 years from what I see now is almost a reactionary place. So I was like, that's never going to happen again. Like, I empowered myself, but it was a reactionary empowerment. So it was more of a in conflict with or in reaction to. But I didn't know it at the time. Like, I felt powerful, and everybody you talked to would have told you that I was very confident. I was very self-assured. I loved myself, like all this stuff. Well, fast forward another 16 years and here I am trained, like armed. I could kill people, you know, and it happened again. And I reacted the exact same way. Now, I told myself in the situation that it was because we were on a national security surveillance mission and they would can the mission, because obviously you can't have that on a team, and that it was for the good of the country and all these other things, right? Which sounded noble. But afterward, I really took a look at it. And again, with the patterns and the symbols and stuff, like, I couldn't deny the fact that that was a repetitive pattern. It was like, wait a second. Like, I could kind of excuse myself when I was 16 and didn't know any better. But when I was 32 and I reacted the exact same way, there were a number of things I could have done, to include not get myself in the situation again. And it took me on a journey through the cognitive aspects of power that really taught me a lot about, you know, I could easily sit back and be the victim and say, you know, they did this and they did this. But it was really a gift, because it forced me to look at all the ways I was doing that to myself on a daily basis, you know, where I was abdicating my own power, where I was acquiescing, or where I was saying no when I meant yes. And not the like rah, rah, I'm woman, hear me roar kind of conversation, but really like, how do I get in touch with that intrinsic power, and recognizing that the energy signature plays a huge role in us communicating things that we're not consciously aware of. So it was such a cool thing to look back on in retrospect, and in gratitude for having had those experiences, because it did set me on the path that I'm on, and I got to choose to go about it differently from that moment on. And so I had to see those two kind of juxtaposed situations to get it. Like, I didn't get it the first time, you know, I got to go through it twice. But it was perfect because it was undeniable. Like, it was undeniable that I was the common denominator, that, you know, it was like, sure, I'm not into victim blaming or anything else, and they have to atone for their part in it and whatever that meant to them. But for me, you know, I really got to the point where I was like, okay, I can blame them and I can go the route of the victim, but it's pretty well assures that I'm going to have to go through something similar again.
Takes away your power, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or I can take a hard look at it and say, okay, what can I do differently? Can I change this? And it's not a popular conversation because, you know, they did something quote unquote wrong. Well, I teach people that we play roles for each other. And so when you've asked somebody to play a role based on your energy signature, then they do that. Like, my husband and I do that a lot in our marriage, is really tap into where we've asked each other to play a particular role so that stuff can be brought up. Well, rather than blaming the other person for being this or being that, it's like, okay, if it's triggering me, then there's something in me that's seeking integration or seeking transformation. I can take advantage of the opportunity, or we can perpetuate this the rest of our marriage, you know? And it's I'll take door number one, you know, thanks.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I want to get in. We talked all around the concept of risk and uncertainty, but we didn't really delve into it. So I did want to get your views on risk and uncertainty. I mean, would you characterize yourself as a risk taker? Do you even look at the world in this way?
It's so funny because when we came out of government, my husband and I started a corporate counterintelligence firm. And one of the businesses that was an offshoot of that, well, that still operates, but we also do risk mitigation in B2B transactions and stuff like that. So it's such a funny conversation because in that world, it really is about helping people make informed decisions. It's no different than the work we do in the superpower arena, but it's under the guise of business transactions and helping people be more empowered and informed in their businesses. Yep. And so I'm very, very, very familiar with risk. And my take on risk is I just like to go into things with eyes wide open. And so for me, it's like, you know, back to that pivotal moment when I just decided to play. You know, I sat with that, like, okay, what are the pros? What are the cons? You know, I didn't get out my whiteboard, but essentially that's what I was doing in my mind. And it was like, what are we talking about here, and what are the ramifications, and are we, is it brand suicide if I come out and talk about this stuff, because we had a very serious, you know, corporate counterintelligence business. And I really equate risk in two capacities. One is, you know, simple decision making. Like, do you want to pay $20,000 to have a website built if you don't know that that company can actually build a website?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe not. Okay, and do a little bit of verification in that capacity. And that's what that one of our businesses does. But the other aspect of risk is truly like what, you know, playing the kind of the what if game with yourself. And when it comes to personal development or being courageous, it's like, what's the worst that can happen? And facing that, because I'm 100% proponent of not allowing fear to dictate my decision making. And the problem with those of us who are very smart is that we're able to over intellectualize things like evidence and proof and all these things. And we will talk ourselves around something. And ultimately, we're just covering up fear. You know, so I just cut to the chase of it. And I'm like, okay, is there anywhere within me that I'm feeling constriction or that I'm experiencing some sort of fear? And sometimes the fear is just like, holy crap, I'm going to do this thing, like skydiving, like, you know, but it's just it constantly increasing your levels of awareness. So you're not kind of mind screwing yourself.
Yes. It's a lot of really good stuff in there, Tony. Like I'm a risk guy. I work in the risk space. That's my day job. And, you know, it can be very analytical and also very linear and it, certainly, you know, very, very important. But I'm totally with you there in terms of the whole concept of the sort of, I think there's power in negative visualization. So, you know, you think about the worst case scenario and then you actually talk yourself through how that could come about and whether or not you could withstand it. And I think that in many cases, just by doing that work, you get a lot of confidence that, oh, actually I would be able to, you know, it wouldn't be that bad. So, you know, maybe we should play a little bit here and take a little bit of a little bit more risk.
Well, and what's so funny about that is that almost all of that leads back to like a fear of death. And so when you can trace it back, it's like we have parts of ourselves that are designed to keep us alive. And so, you know, whether it's back from, you know, caveman days when we were fighting saber-toothed tigers or whatever you want to believe about that, you can almost always trace it back to, I mean, even like reputational issues, like, okay, well, if I do this, what are people going to think? Well, then, you know, maybe I'll get kicked out of the tribe. And then if I'm kicked out of the tribe, I won't have access to resources. If I don't have access to resources, I don't have food. You know, it's like blah, 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 blah. And it's almost always, I'm going to die. You know, it's like,
absolutely.
You know, and when you kind of wrap yourself around the fact that death really isn't the worst thing in the world, then it's like, okay, now we can build from that place.
And our bodies sometimes, you know, that our bodies don't distinguish between the two things, right? Most people who work in an office environment, if you get a shitty email, sometimes our bodies react to it in much the same way as a saber-toothed tiger, right? I'm going to die now. So, you know, now
it's going
to
eat me.
I'm going to lose my job and then I'm going to not be able to get another job. And then I'm all the way to, I won't be able to eat.
Exactly. And that's all it comes back to. Yeah. So it's like, face that fear. And then let's build a fun life on top of that.
And I like the concept of, there's a whole concept of duality here, because you talk about the fear of death, which is a very, you know, it's a primordial fear, but the whole concept of seeking out purpose and play and figuring out how the world works is also, a very human, is a very human quality. And I do agree with you that our society kind of drives us more towards the fear part than the play and exploration part.
Well, and I think that my perspective on this, you said something earlier that reminded me of this. You know, I know it's not popular in intellectual and educated arenas to kind of say that I don't need proof. Like, I don't need the research. But what really shaped that for me was coming out of the counter-intel arena. And I remember making a very conscious decision to disregard and not even look at, you know, news media and other things. And the reason for that was that I was extremely aware of the fact that nothing was true. And so, you know, people think they're informed and they think all this stuff, but I was actively involved with some of those levels of deception and stuff like that. So it's like, you know, I don't like to fool myself. Like, I don't like to, you know, lie to myself. And so when we, you know, my husband and I trained this You know, we have these filing cabinets in our mind, or you know, we store information, and if we don't take in information with the caveat that says, you know, perhaps or maybe, you know, and I caution people, like, have a filing cabinet in your mind that says unverified information. Mm-hmm. And that way you can go through life and absorb all kinds of information, and people will talk to you and they do this and they do that and they believe in this. And it's like, cool, it just goes in that little cabinet, because I don't want to be the asshole in every conversation to be like, well, how do you know that? And is that true? And da-da-da-da-da. It's like, I don't care. Like, what's the bearing on me if that person wants to believe that? But at the point of decision making, and if I'm basing a business decision or a life decision, or, you know, talking about risk, something that involves time and money and some sort of risk to myself, and I pull that information out, we have a three-step process that we train businesses to look at that information and go, okay, how do I know this information? Where did that information come from? And most of it's rumen. You know, and so we have a running joke in our house that if you know, my husband will come home from a networking event and say, hey, I met so-and-so, and they do this, this, and this. And, he, you know, I kind of look at him and he'll go, okay, supposedly, you know. But until it's verified, you don't know. But at the same time, I refuse to live a paranoid existence where I question everyone. It's exhausting and it's not fun and it's not loving, you know. And so it's like, who cares? Just put it in your little filing cabinet and then – But don't make decisions from that place. You know, just live your life. And at the point of decision making, go, okay, I should probably apply some sort of a due diligence methodology here before making a decision. And it's a simple process, and it allows you to be loving and engaging and gregarious and generous and, you know, all of those things with humanity. You know, people ask us all the time how we interact in society if we know all of this stuff. And it's like, I love people. You know, I just don't base my decisions off of anything that's not in resonance for me. And I have my own processes for that.
Very interesting. I'd like to, I know we want to wrap it up soon, but I'd like to get your views on, If my listeners here are, you know, they're probably curious, and if there are, you know, if there's one or two things that they might be able to do to kind of, I don't know, tap some of the things that you're talking about, or, you know, do or stop doing, what might you counsel them? What you say?
Absolutely. Well, I would first look at anywhere where fear is playing a role, and what, how we kind of attack that at a base level is triggers. And again, your listeners are very intelligent and very educated, and I get that. And so some of this stuff feels elementary, but you have to understand that there are parts of us that are in kind of arrested development states, and those are the ones that wreak havoc on our behaviors. And so it you know, I liken it to, if you had a child who didn't know how to ride a bike, would you chastise them for not knowing how to ride a bike because you already know how to ride a bike, or would you take the time to teach them? And so there are pieces inside of us that we just have to teach them how to live outside of fear, and that the world's not the scary place that they're programmed to believe. And so, you know, we work with cognitive triggers, emotional triggers, and vibrational triggers. We have a phenomenal episode on our podcast called Triggered, and we actually replayed it because it's so popular. We have our members listen to it over and over and over again because they hear it differently each time. But it's got practical steps. And so most of us just allow our minds to run amok. And we think that our minds are the decision makers and that they're great. Well, the mind is not an evolutionary tool. The mind can only do what it's already done, or think what it's already thought, or think what other minds have thought. It's not really our intuitive base. And so it's a fantastic tool when you've made a decision from knowingness, and you can bring it on board and help you figure out, like, how to implement something. But when you go to it to make a decision about something evolutionary, like changing your life or being, you know, more in alignment with your highest aspect of yourself, it gets scared, and it's going to share all these stories, which are you know, reasons why you should also be scared and should not do something. And so it wreaks havoc on your ability to create change in your world. And some of this is like basic alchemy, you know, like if you can manage your mind and you work with the emotions and you're conscious of your energy signature, then you're pretty powerful, intrinsically powerful. But I would just suggest looking at that or listening to that podcast, honestly, because, you know, it would probably take us too long to go into too much. But at the end of the day, it's managing the triggers that are keeping you from operating at your highest. And like I said, we all have experience being in that highest frequency, whether it's flow, whether it's like everything just came naturally, whether it's like magically this thing just occurred, this opportunity just came to me. Like, we all use those, again, those noble, educated words for it, but it's just being in your intuition and following that guidance. Well, you know, some people incorporate prayer and conversations with God. You know, some people interact with spirit or energy, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. When you go to that intuitive place first, life really is pretty easy. Most of us aren't trained to do that.
Cool. That's great. I love that. I'd like to wrap it up because I know that you need to move on, but I really, you know, you've certainly opened up my mind gave me a lot to ponder, so I'm very grateful for you to for coming onto the show and joining me here. Before we do go, where can my listeners find more about you and follow you on social media and all the rest of it?
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. It's they can go to superpowerexperts.com and all the social links are there. But pretty much if you look around for Superpower Experts, we pop up in a lot of places. The podcast is on iTunes at Superpower Up Podcast, but there's also links from the website. So that's a great place to get started. And we have experts in, you know, all over the world. We have members all over the world. So if this appeals to people, you know, go to the net page on the Superpower Experts and, just start playing, you know, explore the world a little bit differently and know that we're there to support you and love you and provide you with information that's in alignment with, some higher aspects of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. Tonya, did we miss anything? Was there anything that you wanted to, I know that we could probably continue this conversation and then, you know, we perhaps could do that, at a later date, but was there anything that, that you wanted to say that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
I just want to say that I appreciate you and I appreciate the work that you're doing in the world and the fact that you're willing to tackle some of these conversations and address risk and help open people's eyes to, perhaps just living in a bigger way, or maybe it's a small step forward for them. But regardless, you know, I really appreciate the fact that you're over in your section of the world doing what you do. And I've enjoyed the connection.
Very cool, Tonya. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Ben.
Bye for now. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Check out Tonya and the work she does, all in the show notes as usual. Now, one of the things I took away from this conversation is the importance of play in our lives. And play makes us open to possibilities. It's where ideas come from. It's a core part of being human. It's not something that we should only do as children. And play is also where we get to experience uncertainty. And with that comes wonder and possibility. And all of those things are very much tied to the themes of this show, tied to the themes of All Things Risk. But I'm curious to know what you thought about my conversation with Tonya. Drop me a note, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. Subscribe to the show if you haven't yet done so. Allthingsrisk.co.uk will give you all the links for the best ways in which to do that. We are wherever great podcasts are found. And one of the best things you can do to support the show is to leave a rating or a review on iTunes. That really helps us out a lot. That is it for now. We will be back next week with another episode. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.